Other alternatives that we would start the patient on if we knew their genotype right away. A lot of times, it's changing a little bit, but a lot of times genotype is not performed up front, and the clinicians will start the tamoxifen. If they see no side effects, they'll change the nutrition. They expect the woman to have night sweats and hot flashes, and that just comes with affecting all the estrogen receptors in the breast. If they're not having any of that, they're probably going to move to an aromatase inhibitor, which we probably haven't been exposed to yet, but it's a newer agent of drug that's not dependent on sex. But at the next class of drugs tends to shut down more than just estrogen receptors, so they're not ideal for women who are premenopausal, because there may be a reason that they want to maintain some functionality of their estrogen receptors in case there's the potential to have a child that has. That's essentially it. I mean, when these patients are initially started on these medications, their follow-up is pretty close. And so estrogen, like disrupting the estrogen receptor binding process is something that happens almost instantaneously. It's not something that you have to achieve like a great long half-life steady state. And so usually just by talking with the patient, you can either then say, I think it warrants genotype. Perhaps we just need to go up in the dose because you have a history of chemotherapy-induced gut abnormality. There's other things that can affect drug exposure. They may just not be absorbing it. Their compliance may just suck. So it's one way to tease out, are you actually taking it? Are you taking it but your body isn't absorbing it? And then can your body just not do anything with it based on genotype? So if you can't do it up front, then you have to kind of go through several avenues to figure out what's going on. Yep.
I was wondering, when we're talking about ultra-rapid metabolizers, are we talking about phase 1 and phase 2 metabolism?
You can have them in both classes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They're okay. Just general terms. For metabolizer, ultra-rapid. Sometimes they just have extensive and intermediate. Every group that identifies a SNP comes up with their own kind of.
Okay, so it's not specifically talking about converting a pro-drug to an active drug. It could also be talking about excretion.
Exactly. It can be getting rid of a parent. Something just like voriconazole. Are you guys ready to start again? All right. So I kind of ended abruptly on irinotecan. Does anybody have any questions about that? Is there anything that I need to go back over, or you have the gist of it? And I'll move on to TPMT. All right, I'll move on. So the final drug that I'm going to talk about, and then we'll do the in-class activity, is TPMT. So this is probably one of the oldest examples of how pharmacogenomics can have a significant impact on patient treatment. And it's a really big player in the world of leukemia, specifically pediatric leukemia. So the interesting thing about thiopurine metabolism is there's several different forms of thiopurine that you can give to a patient. So you can give them azathioprine, which is at the top, which is commonly used, I guess I shouldn't say commonly, was commonly used in solid organ transplant for many years, now replaced mostly by MMF. You can give 6-MP, which is typically what is given in the setting of pediatric acute lymphoblastic leukemia. It's very much standard of care for maintenance therapy for all of the patients. And then you can give a prodrug, which is a more potent version of it, the 6-TG way at the top. They're all doing the same thing in this metabolic pathway, where they're inhibiting tumor cells that have mostly leukemic properties to them. So the metabolism is very, very complex. And this slide is actually abbreviated. Some of the steps have been left off. But the point is that TPMT is an enzyme involved in this pathway for inactivating the anti-tumor effects. So it's found in four different spots. When you give this drug to the patient, you presume you're going to get anti-tumor activity, but you don't want that anti-tumor activity to continue forever. You need to eventually shut it down, have the drug cleared, and then the patient takes another dose. That pathway is inhibited, the drug is cleared, and so on. So this is a medication that's taken daily. And if it's not, if the TPMT pathway isn't working correctly, the drug is allowed to accumulate. And the main side effect of this medication is severe and prolonged neutropenia. And the problem with severe and prolonged neutropenia is you put the patient at risk for infection, deadly infection. They usually have to be maintained in the hospital in isolation, so the cost of care is astronomical. And they require platelet transfusions. They require red blood cell transfusions, antivirals, antifungals, everything, basically to maintain them until their immune system recovers. So it's not a good thing for these patients to experience. And in the early age of when we were using multi-regimen chemotherapy with 6MP, many patients died of severe neutropenia because we didn't have the antibiotics and the antivirals to sustain them. So now any pediatric patient that is diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, is going to be genotyped for TPMT. This is standard of care. It's done in all pediatric patients, and it's really changed the outcomes in the patient population in terms of devastating side effects. So the top plot, I'll just give a little bit of background. Approximately 90% of the population is STAR1, so that's normal expression. And so that's going to be represented by the blue curve. Those are just homozygous wild type. They express TPMT. You give the patient the chemo drug. The chemo drug does what it needs to do. TPM clears it, and the patient is ready for their next dose or their next round of chemo. 5 to 10% of the patient are heterozygotes, so these are considered intermediates. So they have one copy of the deficient mutant, and they have one copy of the normal. So they don't express nearly as much protein as they should, but oftentimes these patients do relatively okay with not terrible toxicity. And then you have 1 in 3 patients, which are homozygous mutants. So they just don't generate any protein at all. They don't generate any TPMT or very, very minimal expression, depending on the genotype, and so these patients are at very high risk for developing severe drug-related toxicity. And then the bottom just kind of shows the opposite. So the y-axis shows the active chemotherapeutic agent. On the red bar, that would be patients that have two copies of the mutant. They simply can't clear the active chemotherapeutic agent. So that's why their drug concentrations are very high. The intermediates have moderate levels of the active form, and then the wild type produces the active form but clears it very, very quickly. Oh, and so you, just for testing purposes, you'd want to probably understand the STAR1, the STAR2, the 3A, and the 3C. So you should, there's just not very many of them, so you should have those understood. Oops. All right. So this just gives you a really good example of how genotyping has actually changed the standard of care treatment for something like pediatric ALL. So this is one of the pivotal trials that was conducted many, many years ago by Mary Reiling down at St. Jude. They've kind of been a leader in pharmacogenomics, especially in the pediatric oncology world. So it just compares and contrasts two different strategies of their clinical trial. So what they did is they randomized, they first genotyped patients and found out what their genotype was. So they knew that up front. But then they randomized them to either conventional or genotype-specific dosing. So in the conventional, that means regardless of what their genotype was, they all got the normal starting dose of 6MP. So that would be the first plot. And then the second plot describes what kind of exposure they had based on their mutant status. And then the last one is a plot looking at toxicity. And so the dotted line for the conventional are the patients that had a TPMT mutation, and all of them experienced severe, severe toxicity. That's why their curve is so high. Down here at individualized dosing, you can see the differences in doses based on the different genotype. So the homozygous mutants got about 10% of the normal dose that they would give a patient. The intermediates got somewhere around 40% of the regular dose, I believe. And then the wild types got the normal dose. And then ultimately, the plot that you want to be looking at is in terms of the individualized dosing. So you can see that there's no difference in toxicity for these patients. And so the individualized dosing had really made a big impact on what type of course each child had. So this has become the basis for many, many different pediatric ALL trials. So this is just another plot that's been generated, and it's out there in the literature that people often reference. Because you'll find the package insert is not very valuable in helping clinicians dose based on genotype because this is such an old drug. But it will give you what the phenotype is. So is your patient a homozygous wild type, a heterozygote, or a homozygous variant? It will tell you what the effect is on the active chemotherapeutic entity of the drug. And then it will tell you what you should probably do in terms of dosing. So someone who's got two copies of the normal gene, you're going to start with the normal dose and monitor very closely. Obviously, there's individuality here, so some patients, even though they have normal TPMT, could still experience toxicity. That's why we monitor them closely. Then you have the heterozygote with usually one wild type and one mutant copy. You're going to probably dose reduce that patient anywhere from 30 to 70%. And that can be based on their type of disease and how severe it might be. And then finally, for the patients who have two non-functional copies, you're probably going to do at least a 90% dose reduction in these patients. So let's say the normal dose was 100 milligrams, you would only give them 10 milligrams, and that's going to give the same exact exposure as if they had 100 milligrams and two normal copies. Or if these are non-malignant patients, so we do use this medication in patients who don't have cancer. Maybe they have rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, or some other autoimmune disorders, we're probably going to avoid this drug in them altogether because we don't need any anti-tumor effect. It's mostly immune suppressive, and there's gentler agents that we can use in these patients to better treat them. So now it's time for the in-class activity. And I don't know any other way other than to just hand everything out myself. It goes very quickly. Basically, what we're going to do is there's just going to be four groups in the room. I'm going to hand out four prescriptions that have been written, and you're going to pretend to be the pharmacist that has to decide if you should fill them, how they're written, if you should make changes, if you should recommend a new drug. And I'm also going to provide you with the package insert, just because I want to demonstrate how painful sometimes dealing with the package insert can be. And so I'll pass them out. My only plea is that you don't write on them because I do use them year after year just to save paper. Eventually they say they're going to convert it to electronic for me, but until that happens, I'm using the paper. And then we'll go through each one. So every one is a different prescription for a different drug, for a different metabolic pathway, and you guys can kind of get my thinking as to what I might potentially do for a patient if I was given this prescription based on genotypic information. So you're given the genotype, you're given the prescription. All the prescriptions were written in 2012, so pretend it's 2012, and that's the age of the patient. And I'll give you, I don't think it takes very long. We'll maybe do no longer than 10 minutes working amongst yourselves, and then we'll come back to the group and we'll go through each one. All right?
So the copies that are colored are a prescription and a genotype result, and then the white copies are pectin. So maybe like these first four rows can use irinotecan. Probably have to like share with each other because I just didn't know how many students would be here and how many copies they needed. We're kind of going old school.
Oh, thank you. So I'll probably ask one person in each group to kind of summarize the case and what their recommendations are, so just be prepared to possibly be called on. All right, it sounds like everybody's kind of at a decent stopping point. So we're going to start with the group that had the yellow pamphlets, which is Plavix or clopidogrel. So who amongst you all would like to describe the scenario? Where is all the yellows are up here. All right, whose name starts with a J? Raise your hand. There's not a single yellow person whose name starts with a J. Are you lying to me? How about an M? There's got to be like a Mike or a Matt. All right, I nominate you then to just kind of describe to the group what the prescription is, what SNP is involved, and what you recommend. That would be my recommendation. I don't expect you to have that recommendation available, but you just need to recognize that for this particular patient, since this is a very serious disorder, we're probably treating something like coronary artery disease, we're going to probably pick a different agent based on this patient's genotype. How informative was the package insert? So the information was very buried, and did they give you specific recommendations as to what to do? Just says avoid. Okay. So that's one of the reasons that a lot of this has not been implemented into routine care, because if you're not a pharmacist that's been exposed to this and a patient comes through and says, this is my genotype, chances are that pharmacist is going to be overwhelmed and say, call your doctor. So there's just multiple steps that prevent this from happening on a daily basis. All right. Let's move on to the orange group. So these individuals had the Tylenol 3 case. And you guys are in front. And whose name starts, who was born in October? No one was born in October. Oh my gosh. Okay, September. Seriously. January. Okay, how many? Okay, someone's name starts with a J. All right, you raised your hand first. You're right. I did not write it on a controlled substance script. I'll have to, point noted for next year. But I agree with your assessment. In this day and age, with the amount of information that we know, especially having the genotype for this patient, why would we even bother with coding if we can provide something safer for the mother? So in general, I would say the majority of prescribers at large academic institutions don't even have Tylenol 3 on formulary for certain patient populations. That's not to say that's the case necessarily in smaller institutions where they're less informed. All right, perfect. And in that case, the package insert was relatively informative. Let's move on to Imuran, which was the green group. And where are the greenies? Way in the back. All right, we're going to stick with whose name starts with a J. Do we have someone? Perfect. Let's just assume it's a kidney transplant patient. So the dose would be considered normal if they were going through a kidney transplant. I'll give you that. So are they heterozygote or homozygote? So your choice is there. You're correct. You could completely avoid the agent and move to like a newer drug, which I wouldn't expect you to know, but something like MMF that's kind of replaced azathioprine, or in this case, if this was the only option, it's a smaller institution, they know very little about MMF or other newer agents, you may opt to go with a 90% dose reduction or something. So, how was the package insert? Did it provide any guidance as for a dose? No. Okay. So again, if there's no information there, but it tells you that genotype can play a role, and remember, this is one of the oldest examples of a polymorphism that we have, and it's not even described that well in the package insert, then you end up going to the primary literature, and you're going to probably find one of those publications on one of those tables that I've showed you as to what you probably should do for a patient. Okay? And finally, our last one. And again, if you have any questions, just shout them out. This might have been the more complicated one, just because if you haven't seen a chemotherapy order form before, so I know I didn't get the controlled substance order right, but I got the chemotherapy order right. Chemotherapy orders are much more complex, and it takes you a little bit of time to get through them. So this is the red group, which I think is, oh, no, the gray group. You guys are down in front. And I will again say whose name starts with a J. All right. I'm only picking J because my name starts with a J. So. Yep.
Of the UGT1A1 enzyme.
Perfect.
And so for this polymorphism, the active drug has a low level of glucuronidation, and so this patient would have a buildup of the active drug in their body, and so this person would have an increased risk of neutropenia and diarrhea, and so that's why we would not recommend.
Okay. First of all, that was very complete. And that is how you would want to describe it to your patients, right? So patients don't understand a lot of the complicated things about drug metabolism, but they can understand a higher concentration of drug, a lower concentration of drug, and in terms of side effects, what that means. So you want to, that was a very good example of how if a patient had asked you what you were recommending, that's how you should go about doing it. It's a good job. As for the drug, there's two things that you could do clinically for this patient. There's three things. I'll tell you kind of the three different paths that a provider might take. The first provider may still choose to do the first round of chemotherapy at the full dose and see how severe that patient's toxicity is, knowing that they're probably going to have to do some sort of dose reduction, but they're going for their biggest bang for their buck for the first round. That happens in probably 30% of the cases. The second thing that the provider might do is right off the bat do some kind of dose reduction for this patient, because we know as a provider, if the patient experiences overwhelming toxicity, oftentimes that will push them to make a decision about therapy that's not going to be optimal for them in getting a cure. And we want to avoid that. Then the third thing is for some providers, based on maybe other information about the tumor, they may decide to use a different chemo drug altogether to avoid toxicity. So any one of those would be correct based on evaluating the patient very specifically and talking with the patient about the risks and side effects. So, with that, the additional slides I just kind of provide to you because they're more of a reference. I'm not going to go through them because I could spend 2 hours talking about regulations of genotype and other barriers as to why we're not doing it. But the key thing that I want you to understand is that there's basically three different reasons why a lot of what we're doing in pharmacogenomics is not being adopted. And the first is reluctance. So we really have to start from the ground up and train young providers like yourselves on the topic of pharmacogenomics, because there's many people that are practicing in your field who are expert clinical pharmacists. They do a wonderful job with their patients, but this is a relatively new field and they haven't been exposed to it. So there's some reluctance on their part to want to implement these types of techniques in order to make a better decision for their patients. So you are going to be the generation that's going to walk in and say, I think this is something we should consider. That's just happening in the last 2 or 3 years. The second thing is regulation. The FDA has really started to, especially in the last 10 years, crack down on making sure that people, when they're doing drug development, are actually developing appropriate pharmacogenomic tests to go along with that drug therapy. Because the reason for that is if the test is provided in the package insert, the test is set up in conjunction with the drug all through the clinical trial, the payers can really not refuse to have the genomic test performed. So that's number three. If the FDA says it's in the package insert, it's in your best interest of your patient to do this genomic test to determine what kind of dose they had or alternative therapy, the payers will usually pay for that, meaning insurance companies. If it's not in the package insert, it's kind of a free-for-all for insurance companies to say it's considered experimental, it's not well documented, there's some clinical trials that support it, some that don't, so we're not going to pay for it. And so that's not in the patient's best interest. It should just be afforded to everybody if it truly is a sensitive test for drug response. So the other slides just kind of go through it in more detail. I just wanted to give you information as to where to find more things if you're interested in this kind of topic, because I know that you may have people coming in that are talking about the economics or the availability of pharmacogenomic testing to different groups of people based on economic disadvantage. So those are just more references for you. I'm here to more talk about clinically what we're doing. So with that, if anyone has any particular questions, I'm happy to answer them. I'm happy to answer them by email or CLE. I might not even be saying that. You guys, that might be like 10 years old. I don't know what you guys use now. Okay. However you get a hold of me, I'll get back to you, I promise. But otherwise, that's it. For all of the colored sheets and the package inserts, if you could just pass them into the aisles, I'll just save them, and maybe next year I'll be technologically advanced and put them in electronically. Like a truly translational, someone who has a clinical practice and a...
like maybe either a lab or like works in a lab or like...
I would say myself and Bonnie are probably the only two.
Okay.
We're definitely a new breed.
Okay.
It's not a very well-traveled path yet.
Okay.
So I'm happy to talk to you and kind of tell you how I decided to go down my path and what options. I mean, I'm in drug development at all different phases. So I have a new drug application going to the FDA for a monoclonal antibody, but then some of my drug studies are very old, and we just don't know anything about the pediatric ranges. And I'm happy to talk to you kind of about all the different areas that I focus on.
Yeah, that would be really awesome. I also, so a lot of the pediatric, so I worked at Stanford before I started the program at pediatric SCT as a clinical research coordinator. So it's really
work very closely with the Stanford BMT.
Cool.
That's where our monoclonal antibody IND is.
Okay. Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Anyways, yeah, I'll email you. Maybe we can set up.
Absolutely.
Time.
Yeah. Right. Yep. That's perfect. Yeah. Hi there.
UCSF, is that correct? Or
do I work at UCSF?
Yeah.
Yep.
Is there an opportunity I can like shadow your level? Because you still have the like it was more so taking care of like adult transplant medications. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting just learning all the medications. But I've never actually been like on the floor with a pharmacist.
Can you shoot me an email?
Yeah.
Because I typically I have clinic on Wednesdays, and so we would just have to make sure that, like, all your HIPAA and immunizations and all that kind of stuff are.
Oh, of course.
All, because every patient doesn't have an immune system, so we have a little stricter guidelines. Mm-hmm. But shoot me an email, and we'll see if there's a day that you can come and and kind of see what goes on.
Okay, yeah, that'd be great. Then.
Summertime is a little bit easier.
Yeah, I would probably wait until.
Okay, just because all the residents are gone and all my other students are gone, and so you get more of an opportunity to see without competing with six other people. So,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Just shoot me an email.
Okay, cool.
All right. Yep.